Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey everybody, welcome to Profoundly Pointless. My name is Nick. Coming up in this episode, we're going to jump into some thrash metal. And then because it's getting cold outside, we'll discuss the top five kinds of winter clothing. Gloves? Thick socks? Which one you going with?
By the time I was 13, I was pretty deeply entrenched with like, yes, I want to play drums for a living. I want to be in a band. I want to tour the world. I want to be in the rock and roll field.
The last two songs written for Alien were a song called Skeksis and another song called Shitstorm. And both those songs are pretty damn mighty on the drums. And those did come from like a lot of, you know, just pent up frustration that we both needed to get out. Cowboy sets him up, stands in front of him. He's like, my son, you just can't shit on people.
My mindset is reversed. I think you can have lighter boots if you have heavier socks.
No, I think you go heavier boots, lighter socks. Lie to you. But a neck warmer is different than a scarf. You look like an idiot wearing a neck warmer, which signals to everyone around you, wow, you look so stupid, it must be cold. I want to thank you guys so much for joining us. If you get a chance, like, download, subscribe, share. We really appreciate it. It really helps us out. I was so excited to talk to our first guest. Not just because he's the first rock star that we've had on this podcast, but also because he's a pioneer in thrash metal music. And it's fascinating to me to learn about that kind of music, but also to hear about it from somebody who was there from the start. He's been in a number of different bands over his long career, everything from Death to Fear Factory, Strapping Young Lad, Dark Angel. So he's got some really cool stories that you're about to hear. But there's also this fascinating perspective about how if you know what you want and you're willing to work for it, you can find a way to do it. This is heavy metal drummer Gene Hoagland. Was it always drums or was there another instrument first?
Well, really, for me, it was always drums, even though I got kind of sidelined by what I was allowed to do in school, for instance. Like, I mean, I started off by getting piano lessons when I was a child. And then when I entered seventh grade, you know, I wanted to play some drums. And the beginning instruments class that you were forced to take didn't allow drums, so they stuck a viola in my hand, and I was like, okay, well, I just turned that into a guitar every day when I got home. But drums were the first love. That was the first thing I really, you know, I ever wanted to do. And, you know, when I was about 11 years old, I started formulating the concept of, hey, this is what I want to do for a living. And by the time I was 13, I was pretty deeply entrenched with like, yes, I want to play drums for a living. I want to be in a band. I want to tour the world. I want to make a living at this. I want to be in the rock and roll field. And then by the time I was 13, that started evolving into, I want to be a heavy metal drummer. That's what I want to do. So that's, you know, I've mentioned this before. I am kind of the poster child for living one's dream.
What was it about the drums, though, that attracted you to them?
They weren't challenging. Like, if you pick up a guitar, you're going to be like, but I think everybody has rhythm. Everybody has some kind of, you know, you tap your toes, you tap your feet, you tap your, you know, you beat along on the desk with your hands. Everybody's got some kind of rhythmic tendency. So you didn't really have to, you know, you could learn to play drums by playing air. You know, like air drumming, I'm a huge proponent of it. I grew up before I ever had a drum kit. I had an amazing air drum kit that really worked as the template for getting the drum kit. You know, you got a couple of sticks in your hand. You're,
you're trying to, you know, I would give myself, I guess, you know, like little lessons, I suppose. You know, I'd put on my favorite records and I'd air drum to those, and I'd be figuring out, okay, the kick drum's doing this, the hands are doing this, and oh, here's this fill coming up. I got that one. I can sense what he's doing, so air drum that fill. And I've also mentioned before, my air drum kit was huge. It was gargantuan. It was Neil Peart size. So that was pretty cool. So that you know, it just helped me. By the time I got on a kit, I kind of already had the facilities to the faculties, I guess, to you know, I'm doing okay right out of the gate because I've been air drumming for three or four years, whatever.
When you got started, like, when did you realize you were good?
Well, let me see. The very first time I ever jammed with somebody, I jammed with my cousin. My cousin was 6 years older than me, and I was visiting family in El Paso, and he had a little band together, and so I was 12, he was 18, he had a band going, and he's like, hey, let's, you know, I got band rehearsal later, let's go down a couple hours early, let's see what you got. And he was the first guy I jammed with, and I was able to just keep up with everything he was doing, no problem. I've even got a recording of this, my very first jam on the drums ever. Have a cassette of it stocked away somewhere. But he was like, dude, I did not expect you to sound like you just did. And I'm like, well, I've been air drumming to Rush for the last couple of years, so I should be decent, you know? And he was like, dude, you know, that was killer. So I guess that was kind of the first time I realized, all right, I'm doing all right.
What makes you good at it? Do you just have really good rhythm? Is it a physical thing? Like,
well, I suppose that is a multi-tiered answer. Well, like, I do have pretty decent coordination. I had a real athletic background growing up. Like, it was a matter of, you know, do I want to be a rock and roll drummer for my life, or do I want to really try to enter pro baseball? Because I was really good at baseball. And my dad was always like, hey, son, why don't you try the baseball thing first and, you know, become a multimillionaire by the time you're 30, retire, then start your band stuff. And I'm like, no, Dad, it doesn't work like that, you know? So I think he was always supportive, but I think he was like, man, okay, so this means my son is going to not only become a rock and roll drummer, he's going to become an underground thrash metal drummer. Is there any money in that? Of course not. So, you know, for a while, he was probably shaking his head, scratching his head, just going, man, you should have chosen baseball, kid. But I was happy. You know, that was the thing about baseball, was at that time, baseball had some characters in it, but there was never like a Dennis Rodman, who was like an absolute freak, you know? So I was a freak when I was 13, you know, I had long hair, I had wearing the spikes and the gauntlets, and I was wearing my sister's clothes to games and things like that. And my leagues always kind of scratched their head at me. And by the time I was getting into like, okay, I'm going to perhaps try out for the high school baseball team. My high school baseball team was a great team, and they ended up winning the state championship. However, the coach was like, dude, you're going to have to cut your hair for this. And I'm like, I'm not going to do that. And he's like, well, you ain't going to play on this team then. So I was like, well, that's it then. That's my deciding factor there. Rock and roll doesn't force any kind of rules on me, but baseball here is, I haven't even started yet, and they're foisting all these rules. So I'm not a real rules person even back then. So you tell me to stand, I'm going to sit. You tell me to sit, I'm going to stand. So having that coordination, I think is really good. But for me, and I've always professed this for 30 something years, is drumming for me is 10% physical and it's 90% mental, especially when it comes to playing these fast double bass things and, you know, furious blast beats or whatever. You know, I mean, the band has asked me to play some hauling double bass here. I'm going to figure out how to do that. And so just from early on, I just always figured out the way to get it done.
What drove you into the type of music that you're playing now?
It's the best music in the world. Aggressive thrash metal, aggressive metal. That's my favorite to play. It's my favorite to listen to. Of course, I've got a very wide array of, you know, listening habits, but
But the best for me is, you know, getting to get up there and just, you know, freak out on the drums, play a lot of fast, heavy double bass, and you get all your aggressions out. You know, I'm a pretty mellow person off stage, and my wife tells me, it's like, dude, that's because you get to pound on your drums all day. You know, of course that's going to release any sort of aggression or energy you might have. Yeah, that's gonna help you create this calmness.
Would people be surprised to kind of find out the personalities behind, like, a lot of heavy metal and speed metal and thrash metal? Are they, you know, I think the public would assume that they're kind of these mean, gruff people. Is that the case, or is that not the case?
Well, we like to put that out in photographs, you know, and lyrics. But, I mean, people are just people, you know. You're going to find nice people doing this. You're going to find jerks too. But, you know, I think most people are pretty cool, and especially most musicians, most metal musicians. I think we're a pretty, you know, pretty cool lot, you know. For as many weirdos as there are, there's a million more just down to earth folks. And that's one thing I think was very helpful for my introduction into music, was that I do come from, you know, the thrash metal background, the inception of thrash. I will admit I'm an OG thrash metaler. I was there from the absolute inception of it. And thrash metal was, even before it was called, we didn't call it thrash metal at the time. There was no term for it, but the kind of metal that we were playing was very against the airs that you put on as a, you know, rock and roll star or whatever, you know, like all the, I grew up in LA and seeing all the LA bands and all the bands that would act like rock stars, but you're just a club band. You're just doing all the same thing all the other bands do. You don't need to be showing up to your shows in limousines and all this, you know, all this stuff that your mom and dad would rent for you for your show. You know, it was anti putting on those airs. And, you know, thrash metal to me was supposed to be very down to earth. You should be approachable. You're just a fan who gets up there on stage in the same clothes that you wear during the day. That's what you play in. Don't put on some false front of, I'm this big rock star. You know, I was 16, 17 when I was playing my first shows and being in my first bands, and I'm no, you know, I wasn't an expert at how to act, but it was just like our style of music that we're helping create and attempting to get a scene going with. It's a very down to earth style. So
those teenage and early 20s years, though, of being in a band, what do you remember kind of about that period?
A whole lot of work. I was a very young focus guy. Like, that's one thing I will admit. I had a teenage life unlike anybody else I knew. I mean, there's other people that have had lives like mine, but nobody I went to school with had anything close to a life that I went. I started, my sister was 5 years older than me. She would drag me out to all the clubs. She was 18. I was 13. I was going to, you know, the Troubadour, the Whiskey, the Roxy, the, you know, Woodstock, Radio City, Concert Factory, all these clubs in the greater LA area. I was going to those on a regular basis. And this was, you know, in the early 80s before they would really ID you. I'm going to all these clubs after the show. You know, I'm seeing all the bands that went on to become enormous band, you know, all the Great Whites and Motley Crue's and Rats and Dawkins and all that, all those bands I used to see in the clubs. We'd go to the parties afterwards with the bands. I didn't drink or smoke or anything like that. I didn't do drugs. I did well in school. So my parents were like, we've got nothing really to fault the guy with. I mean, he's not doing anything bad. He's keeping up his grades. Okay, he's not getting a lot of sleep, but he doesn't seem to need much. So I'd go straight to high school, or I'd go straight to school, getting dropped off in junior high after a party, you know, getting dropped off at 8 a.m. at school, and I'd deal with the whole day. So one thing that you know, and these were all the days when these were helping me decide this is what I want to do. So I would be at these parties and I'd see these, you know, future rock stars doing what they do at parties. And, you know, the guys that were just getting hammered drunk, sometimes those guys would not make it to the lineup where the band got famous. You know, so I was like, well, just keep an open eye on this, see what works and see what doesn't. And I'm not into drinking or taking drugs, so that's kind of out of the equation anyway, but just try to learn how, you know, if this is a industry you want to get into, try to learn it from the get-go. So my first few years in a band were me being a young, focused guy. If we'd be out on tour and the rest of the guys want to go party after the show and go to the local club or whatever, cool. I'm going to be in the back of the bus or the van or whatever we're in, the RV, with a guitar in my hand writing the next album.
Did you ever lose that focus, though? Did the lifestyle ever kind of get to you?
To a degree, I suppose I allowed some lifestyle to enter into my life, because after Dark Angel, I'd never drunk or anything before that. And then, you know, I picked up some drinking because I had joined Death pretty immediately after Dark Angel. And I didn't have to do work all the time. I didn't have to, you know, write the music, write the lyrics, do the biz, do the interviews, take care of everything. I didn't have to do that with Death. Chuck was on top of all that. So I had more free time on my hands. So after the show, you know, a lot of times you're stuck with an interview or something like Chuck would be. And I'd be like, I got nothing to do, so I'll nip off this bottle and have some fun. And I don't know if I lost my focus. I don't think so, but I allowed some relaxation into my life, you know, some fun. So after my Death years, I moved up to Canada, and I, you know, I was working with Devin Townsend and Strapping Young Lad and all that. And, you know, I usually entrench myself in whatever town I move to. I'll entrench myself in the local scene, support the bands, go out and see a bunch of bands. And, you know, with that comes some partying. So I got some party on in Vancouver. And since those days, I've quit drinking. I'm a pretty healthy, relatively sober individual. I smoke a little pot. Now I have such a focus on what I do. Now it's, you know, the real important years to remain focused and re-up your focus. Like, I'm 52 now. I started this when I was 16 or whatever, my little career. So I'm 35, 36 years into it now. And now my focus is my next 20 years, my next 30 years. This is something playing brutal, aggressive metal is something I intend to be doing deep into my 70s, and not just in a cute way, like, oh, look, he can still do it. No, I intend to dominate.
As a drummer that you are, doing the, you know, the thrash metal and things like that, could you go into another type of music? Like, could you walk into a jazz band and drum that?
I do all the time. Like, that was one thing up when I left Strapping, or just when Strapping dissolved, and I'm like, okay, well, you're about to enter a real, you know, wide open, independent phase of your career. What is it that you wish to do now, Gene? And I was like, I'd really like to be known as a well-rounded drummer. Focus some of your energy towards, you know, just outside of metal, and, you know, show to people that you can play more than just metal. I am a well-rounded drummer. I can enter a funk project or a pop project or whatever, because I've always felt like as a drummer, you need to support the song. For instance, my drums with Strapping Young Lad was not like the style that I had in Death, and Death was not like the style I had in Dark Angel, and Testament is a style, you know, that is not, it doesn't need to be just drums going crazy all the time. There's a, like, say, a fill that I've recorded, or even a beat or something where I'm like, I don't know if that's the right beat for this song. But if the writer of the song is like, well, that's really the one I'm hearing, that's the one I'm feeling, I'm like, okie doke, well, let's play what you feel, and I'm okay.
Do you have a certain philosophy when it comes to the drum?
The creativity that you put into the brain of the song That's easily brought to the table on the playing side. Like, if you could think it, you could play it. That's the way I feel. So if I think of some, think up some crazy nuts drum fill, crazy lick or crazy beat, if I work it out in my head, I can usually sit behind the kit and get it. You know, I've already got it in my head for the last 12 hours or whatever. You know, when I sit on the kit, I can usually play it off the bat. So that's kind of where that 90% mental comes in.
What is the best band name that you've heard?
There's a hilarious one from a band in LA, and I'm not saying this is a great name or anything, but I love this name because it seems like it would be so hard to chant at a show. This band, they might not even exist anymore, but I saw them on a few bills about 10 years ago. This band was called Intestinal Strangulation. Fun enough name, but how do you chant that? Intestinal Strangulation. Intestinal. Like, how do you get a chant going for that? But I always thought that was fun. But I remember, Dark Angel, back in 1991, we played a show in Hawaii. We played a couple shows in Hawaii, and we had this opening band, kind of a hardcore, kind of a punk band, and they were called BYK. And, you know, we didn't think anything of it, but after the second show, we were like, man, you know, you guys are killer, man. It was a great couple of great shows. Nice working with you. By the way, what does BYK mean? And they're like, beat your kids. I'm like, oh God, that's awesome. Wow, cool. So, you know, very un-PC by today's standards, but I thought that was pretty fun. But
of the bands that you've been in, which name did you like the best?
I come from I've had a career where I have had three rather sillily named bands, and the first one was Dark Angel. I got to admit, man, when I joined Dark Angel, my very first band that I ever jammed with was a band called Dark Angel, and it was completely unrelated to the Dark Angel that I ended up joining. You know, it had nothing to do with it, just happened to have that band name. And I remember, you know, I was like 15 or something like that at the time, and I made the guys change the name because I didn't think Dark Angel was strong enough. You know, I made them change the name to like Carnage or something like that. They're like, okay. But, you know, they had a philosophy to why they were called Dark Angel. And I was like, yeah, your philosophy's bullshit. Let's, you know, why don't we change the name to Carnage?
Yeah.
And then, you know, a year or two after that band, I joined Dark Angel. This Dark Angel, a little more established. I couldn't be walking in going, hey, man, change your band name. So I just embraced it. And then I went from that to Death. I mean, I got to admit, man, when, you know, we were all, I was pen pals with Chuck during the Mantis days. And when, you know, we all paid attention to what was happening in the burgeoning Floridian scene. And when Chuck changed his band name to Death, we were all like kind of scratching our heads like, whoa, dude, that's like, you know, is that cool? Chuck made it cool. But at the time when he changed it, I was like, ooh, Death. I'm not sure about that, bro. And then, of course, Strapping Young Lad. I mean, that's one of the silliest names ever. But it's awesome. Strapping Young Lad was a great name for, you know, just, it would, you would not expect to hear Strapping Young Lad's music coming out from Strapping Young Lad, the name, you know, like, I remember hearing from a lot of people thinking that Strapping Young Lad was like this Blink 182 happy little pop band. Like I back when I used to read like forums and things like that, and people would be on Blabbermouth complaining, Strapping Young Lad, fuck, that band sucks, man. They sound like Blink 182. And then I'd see other people going, are you sure you're listening to Strapping Young Lad? Like, this does not sound like Blink 182 or Green Day or any of that kind of stuff. Sum 41, whatever. So I really enjoyed the name Mechanism for one of my projects. I happened to come up with that one. I thought that was a really cool name. I like Testament. I think Testament's a great name for a band. I remember when they were Legacy, and I've heard the stories of how they got changed to Testament. And when I remember them changing their name, I'm like, Testament, that's pretty cool. You know, cool, strong, one-word name. Way to go, dudes.
Who do professional drummers think is the best drummer of all time?
Most guys would, you know, especially from my era, a lot of guys were super into John Bonham.
I can see why people think he's the best rock drummer of all time. The man was amazing. I admit I did not really discover or get into Bonham until, gosh, I was in my 20s. Neil Peart is considered one of the greatest. And by purists, I know there's a lot of drummers that are better than Neil Peart. You know, more intricate, more, you know, I love Neil Peart. I worshiped the man growing up because I could understand what he was doing. And the fact that Rush was, you know, it was pretty darn prog to me when I'm 9, 10, 11, you know, and I could see where people today would consider Dave Grohl to be the best rock and roll drummer out there. I'd have to agree with that because the man is so tasty, so killer, and I love the guy's work. I wish he played more drums. You know, I mean, he's a great songwriter. Has, you know, I enjoy the Foo Fighters music to a large degree. You know, there's a lot of great drummers out there.
Song of yours that you're most proud of?
Boy, that's, I have over 50 albums out. So trying to pare that down, I tell you, I love the song Skeksis from Strapping Young Lad. I love that song. It was such a fun song to write. It came from an element of purity and kind of aggression and anger from Devin and myself. We were both in some pretty challenging personal spaces in our lives, but when we were writing the Alien record, you know, we were getting into each other's mindsets a lot. And so, you know, the last two songs written for Alien were a song called Skeksis and another song called Shitstorm. And both those songs are pretty damn mighty on the drums. And those did come from like a lot of, you know, just pent up frustration that we both needed to get out. So those are two prime examples there. Oh My Fucking God from Strapping. That's another killer song. And, you know, there's a lot of stuff on Devin's Infinity album. I love the songs. I loved being able to buttress those songs pretty darn well, I thought. So I love the stuff that myself and my wife are writing. My wife is Lara Christine, and she's the best writing partner I've had in 20 years. So she's killer at writing the riffs, and she, you know, sticks on me about the drums. Like I'll play some beats that I think are really cool. She's like, yeah, I don't know, dude. Come on. You're Gene Hoagland. Do something cooler than that. I'm like, okay. She does not lay it out down easy on me. You know, she's pretty tough on me, and I appreciate that. So
is there any songs that you have that were popular ones that you never understood why they were popular?
Merciless Death from Dark Angel. That was, and I think that's because that was our simplest song, but it's always the one that you are like, this is my, you know, there's seven songs on this record, and this is my seventh favorite song on this record, but for some reason it's super popular. And a lot of times I have come into a project after this band has their already established classic songs. And I'll admit there are sometimes in those projects where I'm scratching my head like, wow, you guys have a lot of really incredible songs, yet this one is your popular one? Oh, it's the simplest song. It's the one that just people get.
What's your best rock and roll story?
Oh, Lord Almighty God, Jesus, how do I pare that down to one? Would it be a story that happened to me or a story that was relayed to me? Because my favorite rock and roll story is one that was relayed to me, but I don't even know why this is still my favorite.
How about both?
The one that was relayed to me was my friend Jason McMaster, who I've been friends with Jason since about 1985. Jason used to sing, and still does to a degree, for a band called Watchtower from Austin, Texas. He later went on to be in the band Dangerous Toys. You may remember them. They had some hits in the late 90s. Late 80s, and were doing a lot of really cool touring. And he was telling me about the time when they were out on tour with a band called Saigon Kick. And I'm really familiar with the name Saigon Kick. I'm not super familiar with their music, but, and he was saying that, and I could have the band name wrong. It could have been somebody else, and we could have been talking about Saigon Kick during the same conversation, but I've always remembered it as he was on tour with Saigon Kick, and Saigon Kick's vocalist, I believe, you know, he was really sick, and he wasn't taking care of himself. Like, he wasn't, like, pounding the C's and doing all that. He was eating just big steaks and doing horrible things, and his gut wasn't doing well, and he was, you know, drinking cough medicine and just churning his guts. And he, like, one of the guys from his band was just taking a nap on the front lounge couch of the bus, and he walked by the guy, dropped his pants, merely intended to fart in the guy's face, but he followed through. And so Buddy gets up, trying to kick his ass, and he runs to the back of the bus, locks the back of the bus, and, you know, guy who just got shit on is trying to kick down the back door of the bus, and the bus driver gets on, and the bus driver was named Cowboy, and the bus driver liked to kind of terrify the band with some of his stories about what a fucking hard human being Cowboy was, you know, like raping dudes in prison and that sort of thing. And so Cowboy gets on, calms the situation down, pulls the guy out of the back of the bus, takes him outside the bus to, like, the back of the bus, and the guy who did the shitting his pants, because he's like, he's heard all the stories from Cowboy. Cowboy's about to take him off and into this little, you know, secluded little spot. He's like, I don't know what this guy's about to do to me. Cowboy sets him up, stands in front of him. He's like, my son, you just can't shit on people. And God, that, I've just howled about that, to this day. Son, you just can't shit on people. I just thought that was the most funniest thing I'd ever heard. That was 25 years ago that I heard that, so there's probably a bunch of funnier ones that have come along, but, you know, there were a lot of things that weren't funny at the time, like when Dark Angel was, we were on tour in 1989, and we were traveling from Portland to San Francisco, and that's about a 10-hour drive, and we had just played Seattle the night before Portland, and this guy had come up to us and said, hey, I'm trying to work my way down to San Francisco. Could I maybe jump on your tour, do whatever odd jobs you guys need, and just help you guys out for the next couple of days? And we were all young and stupid, so we're like, yeah, sure, man, come along, man, we'll put you to work. And sure enough, we did in the Portland show. And as we're driving from like I said, it's a 10-hour drive. I am driving the equipment truck, and we are now in Dunsmuir, California from Portland. That's probably 7-8 hours sort of thing, 6-7 hours. It's a healthy haul. And I pull into a service station, and I'm getting out of the van. I mean, out of the truck, and I've got this guy. He's my co-pilot, you know. And then I see our RV, who was following behind me, carrying the rest of Dark Angel. I see them pulling up, and there are 6 cop cars behind them, all with their lights on, all flashing. I walk into the store to pay for the gas, and Buddy's looking at me. Buddy's behind the counter looking at me kind of strange. And, you know, I'm kind of looking past him out the window and seeing, you know, a lot of cop cars. And then I see there's 6 cars. I see 12 cops get out of their cars and point high-powered rifles at our RV. And I'm like, because the first thing I'm thinking is like, where the guy's like swerving? We're not going that fast. I've got a governor on this thing, and they're following me, so I can't, you know, I'm not doing 80. Like, it's not like we're speeding. Like, why are my guys getting pulled over? And the guy asked me, are you with that RV? Are you with that RV of long-haired bikers? I'm like, wait, long-haired bikers? What? And they're like, well, we've
we've all, up and down the 5 freeway here, we've all been getting calls from the police. All the hotels, all the restaurants, all the gas stations been getting calls from the police for the last hour. They've been following you for an hour because they are under the impression that you guys are a rolling meth wagon traveling from town to town delivering meth. You got a bunch of long-haired bikers in there, and they're waving guns around, and they're pointing guns at passing motorists. I'm like, wait, what? Now, I know there's weapons on our vehicle. Dark Angel Tour, there are weapons, guaranteed. However, none of my guys are stupid enough to be pulling out their weapons and waving them around. However, I started thinking back to a couple of days before all of this when we were in Salt Lake City. We did an in-store at a place called the Heavy Metal Shop, well-known on the scene at the time, record store. Next to that record store was a toy store where the band all got themselves water pistols that looked real. And so I'm like, wait a minute, these guys, you know, I could see them waving around water pistols inside the van, inside the RV, spraying each other down. I get that. So I'm like, oh shit. And they're pulling each guy out one by one, you know, like the cops on the bullhorn, you know, you get out, hands up in the air, drop to your knees, drop to the ground, hands spread out. I'm looking, and one by one, they're pulling the band and crew out, lying them down on the ground. Then they're done with, you know, I see my last member get out. They got those guys situated. Then all of a sudden there's like, you know, 10 cops that rush the store, come grab me, force me out. And this whole time I'm thinking, actually, before I'm even thinking the water pistols, I'm thinking this guy that we've picked up, this guy's a serial killer. They're looking for this guy. You know, I mean, Green Mountain, the Green River Killer, he's somebody, you know, he's a serial killer. They're looking for this guy. That's when guy behind the counter had explained, no, here's what they're actually looking for you for. And so they come grab me, throw me on the ground with everybody else, and they explain same thing that Buddy explained to me. We think you've got weapons. Where are the weapons? Tell us where the weapons are. We're like, we don't have any weapons. And then we hear a cop, you know, they're searching the vehicle. We hear a cop from inside. We found the weapons. We found the guns. And we're like, oh shit, God, did they find our actual stash of weapons? And then you hear another cop go, oh shit, they're water pistols. And so, you know, they had us, you know, and at the time, it wasn't funny at the time, but, you know, we got some humor out of that later on, but there's some rock and roll stories for you.
That's pretty much all the questions I got, man. What do you got coming up?
Well, let's see. I've got next week, about 10 days from now, we start rehearsals for a Death Clock show that is coming up. That's pretty cool, if you're familiar with Death Clock.
Yeah,
I'm real excited about that. That's going to be really awesome. It's going to be our first show in about 5 years. So that's what I'll be doing when this interview's over. I'll be heading down to my rehearsal space, and I'm getting prepared for it. So I'm going to hit that first rehearsal like it's our 12th show. You know, it always takes a few days to get your legs when you're, you know, going out on a fresh tour with a band. So, and this isn't a tour, it's just a single show, but I want to make sure that I'm super prepared for it. So that's coming up. That's going to be at a place called the Bank of California Stadium up in LA. And perhaps by the time this airs, you know, we could have already played the show. The show happens on November 15th. So I'm pretty excited about that one. That's going to be cool. And then I've got some Dark Angel shows coming up in early December. And that's in Mexico. And I've got some clinics in Mexico following those shows. And I know there's some Testament stuff coming up. Let me see. I know we got a tour going on in February. Oh, yeah. Testament is in the middle of December. Testament will be traveling to Kathmandu, Nepal, playing the first show there for the band. So that'll be interesting.
I want to thank Gene so much for joining us. If you want to connect with him, we have linked to him on our social media accounts. We're Profoundly Pointless on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And we've also included his social media links and links to his website on the RSS feed that's on this podcast. If you couldn't tell from that interview, he's the nicest guy in the world. When I first called him and heard his voicemail, I was expecting something completely different. And it turns out he's the nicest man ever. Okay, so now let's go ahead and give John Shull a call, who may or may not have a big announcement.
Hello?
What's your thermostat set at right now?
Currently it is at 67 degrees.
Hmm. Why 67?
What
Why
is not? Yours set at?
Mine's set at 62.
No, it isn't. Yeah. Nobody has their thermostat set at 62 degrees.
I do. You're going to tell me you can tell the difference between 62 and 67. You could walk outside and be like, nope, that's not 62. This feels more like 66.
I know for sure that there's a difference between 62 degrees in my house and 67 degrees.
I mean, it would be a little bit colder, but I don't think it would be that much noticeable. I don't understand the point of 67. Why wouldn't you go 65 or 68? Those seem like much better numbers.
I mean, you just asked me what it was set at right now. Normally, I have this weird thing. I don't like it. I don't like the numbers not to be even. So if I could, I would want it to be 68.
Why?
Like, that's what I have it set at.
But why is it set at 67 right now?
It's this whole long thing, but there's this eco setting when we're gone from the house. It's this whole thing.
So then why not put it to, if you like it at even numbers, why not put it to 66?
Because it goes down to 62 when nobody's there. And then when somebody's in the house, it goes back up to the temperature that you set it at.
But you said you like it at even numbers, and yet you set it at an odd number.
No, it's not set at an odd number. That's just what it is right now while it gets back up to 68.
Okay. Are you going to be able to tell? Let me know exactly when you can tell the difference that it's now back at 68 from 67.
Listen, I have a question for you.
Okay.
Do you think when someone asks you how your day is going, or anything like that, do you think they really give a shit?
No, not at all. No, but, I think people actually do not expect you to answer with anything besides not bad. It's a form of conversation. They're not really asking you that question.
A formality, right? It's like, oh, hey, yeah. Here's this guy. I'm just going to say, you know, how's your day going? No, I don't even care.
Yeah, no, I mean, I regularly ask people, like, how you doing? And keep right on walking, not expecting them to answer it whatsoever. I think you should start answering in paragraphs, essentially. Like, you know what? My dog died today, and I'm a little depressed. Maybe not something that example, but just be like, oh, they didn't have, you know, I wanted to get something to eat before I came into work, and then they didn't have the exact thing I wanted, so I had to try something else. It was pretty good, but not what I wanted. Like, go into a whole thing anytime somebody asks you that question.
Have you ever had, like, the random response that you did not expect, and you're just like, oh, well, that's awkward?
No, not really. I don't really ask people that question. I'm a more what's up man. If you ask somebody how you're doing, they might actually give you an answer. If you just give them like a what's up, they understand that you just go not much and keep going about your day. Your approach is too open-ended.
Well, I mean, some would argue that's my lifestyle.
Being open-ended? I don't know what you mean by that.
Listen, I can tell a story? I want to tell a story real fast.
They're always boring, though.
No, I think you're going to like this one.
Here's the problem, right? This is like a bunch of friends of ours always wanted to come on the podcast and talk about stories. The problem is people's stories are only interesting to you. Unless you're like a rock star snorting lines of cocaine off the sides of the Alamo, like your stories aren't that interesting. It's just, okay, great. Yeah, we've all been drunk before. It happens.
I mean, actually, it was me doing cocaine off the side of the Alamo. How did you know that?
How about let's do this? I'm going to grade your story on a scale of 1 to 10. If it is not a 7.5 and above, you can never tell a story again.
Okay, that's fair. And I will even do my best to keep it under 2 minutes.
No, it needs to be 30 seconds tops.
I don't know. I don't know if I can do that. I'll try.
Okay, I'm going to start timing you. Hear about this. Every 30 seconds after the 30 seconds, I'm going to knock it down a point. Like from 7.9 to 7.8 to 7.7. Okay. So if it's not, that's the deal. If it's not over a 7.5 or over, you never get to tell a story again.
All right, fine. That's fair.
Okay. Clock starting.
All right. So, Friday night, I was with some people. We were going out. We were pre-drinking beforehand. There was a picture, in the basement that I was of me on my wedding day, giving a certain face of like ultimate like excitement, didn't expect it, blah blah blah.
That's the
story? Best part is I point to my right. It was me and my wedding party on my wedding day, and the couple people were like, you know, what's going on? Why are you making that face? Like, it looks like somebody just shoved their hand up your ass. So I got to tell the story about how, you know, on your wedding day, you're supposed to take pretty formal pictures until one of my groomsmen, you might know him, his name's Nick Van Zandt, decided to shark attack my butthole, causing me to have this reaction, which my photographer then snapped the perfect frame of me half enjoying but yet half hating getting a hand shoved up my ass.
Is that the whole story?
You told me to keep it short. It was a hit. Everyone that was there that did not know the story immediately thought you were the best person ever.
That's like a 2.5.
No, it's not. It's a good funny story. I'm gonna post the picture so people know what I'm referring to.
The problem is, here's my problem with that story. You're aware this is a podcast, correct?
Some days.
So a podcast is mainly an audio story. So you've told a story about something that is visual in an audio format.
I don't understand why you have to hate so much.
Because,
I mean,
look, this is what I brought up at the beginning.
If people have an issue with it, find another co-host then. Find somebody else that will let you shark attack them and not knock you the fuck out.
Look, there's probably about 5 or 6 people I've shark attacked that day alone. A shark attack is a very well-known way to get after somebody. Have you never been shark attacked before that?
That was my first and last time I've ever been shark attacked.
You need to involve more shark attacks. It's a very humorous way to just bother someone in a random setting.
You know, I don't think you give my stories enough credit. I don't think people hate my stories as much as you hate them.
No. It's nothing against your story. It's against the medium of the storytelling, right? Like, it's a great story to the people who are aware of it and who can see the picture. But if you can't see the picture, then the story is kind of meaningless.
But isn't that what a podcast is? Like, we're painting, like an audiobook, like we're painting pictures for people.
Well, then you've got to be more detailed in the expression on your face, right? Like, I don't feel like you painted the picture for me.
Yeah, it's hard for me to really describe what my face looked like, having a fist up my butt.
So this is the thing that I think a lot of people do now, right? Like, they claim that you're hating on them, or you're being negative, or you're being mean or rude, when you're really just pointing out basic facts that even in the course of this argument, you've agreed to, right? Like, you're mad at me for pointing out the fact that you didn't paint a word picture, which you agreed to, telling a visual story in an auditory medium. So, like, you agreed with my criticism of it, but yet got mad at me for criticizing you about it.
I'm not really mad. Nobody was arguing there. I mean, I don't disagree with you. I think people should get called out. I don't agree with your statement of people don't want to hear stories that you can't, you know, show because it's a podcast, that, you know, they need to be some kind of other story. Then, I mean, there's only one kind of story to tell, and we talk about them all the time.
What is it?
Just story, any kind of story. Like, there's no doubt we paint pictures of stories or comments or questions.
I'll give you a little bit more credit and bump it up to a 3.25.
That's fun. I could have told a story that, you know, won me a literary award, and you're still going to give me the highest of 4.7.
No, I would have legitimately probably. I thought that maybe I would be a little bit hard on you to begin with, so I actually factored that into it. Like, you can see in my reaction that I didn't even know the story was over.
Well, you told me to keep it brief, so that's what I did.
Like, but I was waiting, and then I was like, oh, we saw this picture, and then we carried it around to the bars with us, drinking all night long, and I ended up in a different country. Like, oh, okay, there's a good story.
Well, listen, that doesn't happen, okay?
I mean, it could happen. You live right next to Canada.
That is quite true, actually. That is actually quite true. I live like 15 miles from the Canadian border. You're absolutely right.
Could you swim? Could you swim over there?
Oh, I can boat to Canada.
Do you have a boat, or would you have to borrow someone else's boat?
I'd have to borrow somebody else's boat. We don't have a boat anymore.
You used to have a boat?
Yeah, my father used to have a fishing boat.
Okay, you didn't have it. Your father did. That's not we.
I said we had it.
But he had it. You didn't have it. It was never yours. It was always his. You just happened to be his son. He just let you use it.
I got to drive it. So technically, I was a captain of the ship multiple times.
But it's not yours. It's his, and he kind of lets you use it because you're his kid.
Well, he didn't, actually. He gave it to one of my best friends for nothing and completely passed me up. So thank you, Dad. Appreciate that.
So basically, the boat that you said was yours was never yours. It was actually given to a friend in spite of you.
That's a fair argument. Thank you for bringing up a sore subject.
And he gave it to him for free? How much would you have paid for it?
I wouldn't have paid for it. That's originally why I was told that he was giving it to somebody else, was because that person had agreed to pay a little bit of money, and my father thought that he would use it more than I would, which is probably correct.
That's true. How big of a boat are we talking? Give me the footage.
It was a 20-foot fiberglass, just like little like recreational fishing boat, nothing crazy.
What kind of motor? What's top speed?
Outboard, probably, I don't know, probably 30, 35 miles an hour.
Oh, because you could water ski behind it if you wanted to.
You could have, yep.
It's pretty solid. Does it have a deck, below deck?
It does have a little cuddy cabin, yes.
Oh, okay. I'm impressed with your boat knowledge. If you can tell me where the bow, the stern, rear, and aft is, I'd be really impressed.
That's not going to happen. I always fail that.
I don't know what the answer is. You could have literally said anything, and I would have just agreed with you. I'm pretty sure the bow is the front. The stern is the back.
I'm pretty sure that's correct, but I'm not going to go out there and put my name out there.
Okay. I'm going to look that up. Are you ready for your segment? Oh, here's a whole description. All right. The bow is the front. The stern is the back. Starboard is the right side, and port is the left side.
You learned something new.
Okay. Who knows? Let's move on.
All right, so let's start off with this one here. When you die, would you rather be cremated or buried in the ground?
Cremated. I feel like the whole burial process, now that I really think about it, is just kind of weird. Like, your body's just, you're just laying down there, like your bones are just at the bottom, just sitting there. That's kind of weird.
I always wonder about that. Like, who decided that it had to be 6 feet in the ground?
No, it's a good question in the sense of, like, why 6 feet as opposed to 5 feet? And did they measure it? Are they actually measuring it 6 feet down? Like, oh, no, buddy, that's 5.5. You got another 6 inches you got to get. Maybe it has something to do with the water table. I don't know.
Like, I don't know about you, but I want to be Han Solo'd. I want to be frozen in time.
And just mounted, like, in your house? Stuffed like a taxidermy.
Like, I want my grandkids to be like, I don't know who that guy is, but he's just hanging out and he's kind of a badass. He's a badass looking, statue.
You know what? That's a question that we could maybe have answered. If you wrote it in your will and wanted to be stuffed like an animal, could you be taken to a taxidermist and have a human body stuffed?
I 100% think that you could. Well, I mean, why couldn't you? They do it to other creatures.
Oh, it's illegal. It is illegal to mount a person in the United States. Why couldn't you, though? I don't understand. Like, look, it may be technically illegal to stuff a human body like a taxidermist, but if that's what the person wanted, like, why couldn't you do it? What's the big deal?
Do taxidermists, do they have to report to some agency, like, what they taxidermy? Like, if I wanted to have it done, and, like, I found a taxidermist to do it, even though it's illegal, would they still do it?
I would think if I
wanted them to?
I mean, I would think that it would just be way too much to regulate that, because otherwise taxidermists would be, I stuffed the dog today, stuffed the deer. Like, who's going to be reading all that crap? Nobody's going to be paying any attention to it. I think even if they did do it, you could get away with it. But what's your next thing?
Thanksgiving or Christmas? Which one do you not want to be a part of more?
Oh, extended family, immediate family?
We'll go immediate family.
Immediate family, I probably don't want to deal with Christmas. I generally don't like watching people open gifts. I don't like people watching me open gifts because I generally don't like any of them. I would have rather you kept the money. I really didn't want this fucking sweatshirt. So immediate family, I would rather not be around them for Christmas, and I'd rather take Thanksgiving. If I've got to be around extended family, I'll do that for Christmas.
All right, and finally, what's better, taking a shit in the morning or a hot shower in the morning?
Taking a poop. The fact that you don't shower at night is still gross to me. That's just disgusting.
But, I mean, I wake up and I get all the crusties off. I mean, or I can go to bed after showering and then wake up and, you know what I mean? I mean, that I don't care when you shower. I choose to shower in the morning.
It's just gross, though. But you went to bed with all of that day's nastiness all over you. You're essentially sleeping in your own filth every night.
There's a lot of jerking off going on.
I would imagine so. What are these sheets made of? They're 9% cotton and 91% sperm.
I think we need to segue into our top five.
Okay. So our top five is going to be top five winter-related clothing items. What's your number five?
So I have my number five is thermal wear.
Okay, thermal wear, you're talking about like long underwear, right?
Yeah, you know, like it doesn't have to be this brand, but like, you know, the Under Armour, like, heat gear or some kind of thin layered something that goes under the rest of your clothes to help keep your body temperature in.
Okay. I never understand stuff like that. I mean, it's not that far from your car to your house. Just tough it out for a couple of minutes. Like, you really aren't going to survive. You're really that worried about it. I just think it's a mindset with people. Like, oh, I'm so cold. No, you're not.
Man, you are just brutal. Your Norwegian ancestry is really kicking in here already.
Technically Swedish. I don't know if that's Norwegian or not. I believe Norwegian is Norway. I'm from Sweden. No, I just think that's why I asked you the question about the thermostat. That if you went in there and just cold call asked somebody what the temperature is, you couldn't tell the difference between 62 and 72. But the temperature drops to 62 and everybody's got to have a coat and their thermals and their gloves and their mittens, and you wouldn't know the difference at all. It's just a mindset thing. Like, just put in your mind you're not going to care about it and move on about your day. My number five
is Nostradamus. What's your number five?
Nostradamus predicted the future. He did not analyze the future present, which is what I just did.
What's your number five?
Snow pants. You got to have a
choice.
Yeah. I mean, I just can't look. You're great for skiing. They're great for sledding. They're great for just going outside. It's just snow pants are solid.
My number four, I have boots. You need like good winter boots.
I think that's too low, man. I think that's a good call, but I think that's too low on the list.
We'll see. I got some good ones coming up.
Okay, where do you put your boots? Do you take your boots off at the door to your house? You tracking them in through the whole house? What are you doing?
We have like a little landing, from like our I don't know what room you call it, I guess our front room.
Foyer.
Foyer. To our foyer. So like that's where all the clothes taking off usually happens, if you catch my drift.
I do. This is probably what leads to all your excessive masturbation. Wait,
Mommy, what's that polar bear doing in the window?
Do you have like a rack that you put them on, or you just put them straight on the floor?
During the winter, they'll just go straight on the floor. But when they're hibernating, see what I did there? Mm-hmm. During the summer, we built like a little rack for them to get off the floor.
You built a rack.
It's really, yeah, it's not that difficult. It's just a couple of, you know, a couple of planks of wood and, you know, just, it's not difficult.
Was it level? I feel like it's probably not level.
I mean, it hasn't fallen apart yet.
I want to see a picture, because here's what I'm imagining. I'm imagining this looks like a 2-year-old did it. Like, it's crooked, it's one piece of wood, and then another piece of wood. Like, it just looks like crap. I want to see a picture of what it looks like.
I will be happy to send you one.
Okay. My number 4 is thick socks.
Okay. I also have socks on the list, but kind of what you just said about my boots at number 4, I think socks should be higher myself.
See, but here's why I didn't put it higher, is because if you have good boots, then you don't need the thick socks, right? You're protecting your feet from the beginning.
My mindset is reversed. I think you can have lighter boots if you have heavier socks.
No, I think you go heavier boots, lighter socks.
I've done it both ways. I've done it always.
I know that. Now, that's another story that you should have told. What's your number 3?
I have socks are my number 3.
Okay. All right. My number 3 is a beanie or a hood. I think those are really important.
All right. My number 2 is the hat. So,
a hat?
Well, you know, a winter hat, winter beanie.
So we're talking about the same thing.
Winter headwear. But can we both agree that maybe the most disappointing thing when it comes to working outside in the winter is if you have like a winter beanie on? Is it could be 10 degrees outside and you're shoveling the snow and you go inside and you're a ball of sweat. And you're like, how am I sweating when it's 10 degrees outside?
Because like I said earlier, people over dramatize how cold it is. I've never understood that idea. Like, I'm sweating like a madman under all these layers. You didn't need all of them. You could have just went out there in a long sleeve shirt and you would have been fine.
I mean, to be honest though, I don't know if you've ever lived in a state where it's gotten extremely cold.
Kansas. You drop into the negatives in Kansas with wind chill.
Okay. All right. I guess I'll have to read up on my Kansasian weather.
Kansan. It was Kansas weather.
It's just Kansas. We're so fucking plain. It's just Kansas.
It's just Kansas, man. It's not Kansas. The Midwest, that part of Kansas, Nebraska, Oklahoma, has the worst weather in the entire country. I'm not talking about isolated incidents and the extremes, but they have everything, right? It'll get up to 110 and it'll get negative 10. It's just awful. It's the worst place in the world.
What's your number 2?
Boots. Good pair of boots. Okay. Ooh, I thought no way would we have the same number 1. What's your number 1?
Gloves.
Yeah. I didn't think you would put gloves. I think gloves are the most important thing.
I agree. The reason why I have socks and gloves so high on the list are because to me, like my body temperature, I know this isn't the way it is, so I'm not saying it from a scientific standpoint, but if my fingers or toes are cold, I'm cold for the fucking rest of the day.
Yeah. Once it gets in there, you can't get it out. That's why hands are awful.
Like I don't care if I am 275 pounds as of last year. If my hands or feet are cold, I'm fucked.
What kind of gloves are you going? Are you going like nicer gloves? Like those isotoners they used to have commercials with? Are you going like the cheap cloth ones? Are you going full on mittens?
No. I learned about 10 years ago that I will spend a little bit extra money to get some good gloves.
How much are you spending on a good pair of gloves? Give me a number.
Probably between 20 and 40 bucks.
Is that a good pair of gloves? I feel like that's just above decent.
Oh, I mean, maybe. I don't know. To me, to me, that's you know, that's an acceptable price range.
Well, I mean, if you get 40, that's pretty far up there. I guess it depends on, like, if you're getting ski gloves, 40's not crazy for a good pair of ski gloves, in my opinion.
Like, I'm not going to CVS and getting, like, the $2.99 winter gloves, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, those don't really work very well. Do you have an honorable mention?
Not really. I tried thinking of stuff. There's really only so many articles of winter clothing.
I don't think that men should wear scarves. I really just don't. It's pointless, right? Like, oh my gosh, my neck is cold.
Yeah, scarves make no sense. If you have four chins like I do and three necks, you're not going to be able to stay warm. It's just the way it is.
Would you have to wear multiple scarves?
Oh yeah, I'd have to like have them sewed together. I'd have to wear a blanket around my neck.
Just full blanket. Have you ever had I've had a neck warmer though skiing. Actually, it was pretty nice. I'm not going to lie to you. But a neck warmer is different than a scarf. You look like an idiot wearing a neck warmer, which signals to everyone around you, wow, you look so stupid, it must be cold.
Yeah, where I'm from, a neck warmer is something we put on other parts of our body.
Like what? What do you put it on?
You should cut it there. I think that's a good thing.
No, I want to know what you would put it on because nobody is genetically gifted enough where they would need to have a neck warmer anywhere else.
Hey, some people may be genetically gifted. I don't know.
Not 13 inches in circumference gifted.
Yeah, that's the case. I feel bad for any woman and or anything else that comes in contact with it.
I think it would have to be anything else. I don't think any women are. I don't think anybody's essentially handling the circumference of a small pumpkin dealt in there. Okay, that's going to go ahead and do it for this episode of the Profoundly Pointless Podcast. I want to thank you guys so much for listening. If you get a chance, like, download, subscribe, share. We really appreciate it, especially if you can leave a review. Hopefully a good one. If you actually listen to the show on a regular basis, though, we completely understand why it would be a bad one. But mention John's name in the bad review so I can specifically blame him.